Ante Up is your poker magazine dedicated to the everyday player and their poker rooms. Pick up a free copy at your favorite poker room nationwide each month. But Ante Up is much more than a magazine. Visit anteupmagazine.com daily for breaking news and each week download our award-winning poker cast. Join us on our action-packed poker cruises to exotic destinations and find special deals on Ante Up gear and great poker products at anteupstore.com. Ante Up. It's your poker magazine.
From the WDAE Sports Animal Studios in Tampa, Florida, it's the Ante Up PokerCast. And now here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's March 28th, 2014. You are listening to the best PokerCast on the planet. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
What's going on, buddy?
Hey, we're back in town, just briefly.
Yeah, and then going back out again. I remember like it was like 3 or 4 weeks ago you said to me, hey, get ready not to see me for like 2 months. I said, okay.
Yeah, just before this last trip, I think I posted on Facebook my next 68 days, and it was one of those continue reading posts, listing every city I'm going to be in, city and country over the next 2 or 3 months here. So crazy travel, but last week I was down in South Florida, which I get down to quite often because there's so much poker down there, always stuff going on. This time, particularly, a lot of stuff going on, a couple new poker room managers, a couple new rooms open, and just a lot of stuff to get down there and check out. So actually did a lot more work than I normally did rather than just shaking hands and kissing babies and stuff, right?
Yeah.
And so a ton of interesting stuff came out of it, and we'll split it over the next couple shows so I don't bore the people that don't like the academic part of what we talk about here. But I had a couple great conversations with managers about just, you know, topics in general, and it's stuff that I think we'll probably write about in the magazine at some point. But it's phenomenal stuff to talk about in the show, because I know our listeners like always have opinions on this kind of stuff. So here's the first one, and we'll talk more next week about it. But you know, one of the really interesting discussions I had with somebody this this trip was about what quote unquote numbers motivate players,
like 6 or 12 or
exactly, you know, 18. 6, I'm in. I call. 7, no, I'm out. No, but two kind of very different but related conversations I had. So here's the first one. The first one centered on the guarantee versus the actual prize pool. And what I mean by that is, for example, how much do players care about a big guarantee if the tournament is projected to have a prize pool that far outstrips the guarantee? So let's say the guarantee is 25,000, and that's enough to get, for whatever reason in your region, that's a tournament that just, you know, mind-boggling for you, right?
Right.
But you know the prize pool is going to be 30,000, at least, just from the buzz going on. Is that 25,000 guarantee what motivates player, or the fact that the prize pool will probably be or exceed 30,000?
Is that rhetorical, or am I supposed to say something here?
Well, I guess we'll pause here. We'll have a second discussion on the next one.
Okay.
And let me give it a more focused way of thinking about this. Let's say you've had a very successful tournament, with a very high. You put a high guarantee on a tournament 1 year. It knocked it out of the ballpark, right?
Right.
It was just the same example, 25,000, right? And then prize pool swelled to 45,000, right?
Right.
Next year, what do you do? Do you raise the guarantee because you need to keep keep up with the Joneses, I guess? Or is it the fact that are players going to come to that tournament next year regardless of what the guarantee is because they know last year you got 45,000? As a player, what do you care about more?
As a player, I care about the cash games. So I know I'm an ass.
Oh, is there any good discussions?
No. Here's the deal. I've never. Now you got to remember, I don't play a lot of tournaments anymore. But when I was going to play a tournament, I just went to play because I wanted to play. And then when it was a money factor, I didn't care about the guarantee. I just wanted to know that there were going to be players there and it was going to be worth playing and it was going to go off. And you know, I was going to be able to get my money's worth from. You know, I look at a lot of things when I'm playing poker from a tournament standpoint. You know, structures, distance. So there's a lot of things that come into factor with me. And if the last thing was the money, I would want to see a guarantee that I know I'm going to make X amount of dollars if I cash or win. You know what I mean? It's hard to really put into words what I'm looking for. I guess the money is like the last thing for me because I don't play for a living. If I were playing for a living, I would need to know that, you know, the money is worth the trip and everything else. So I'm not really sure how to answer that other than I know you sort of went all over the place with that in the beginning about what do you do with the if you're a manager, what do you do? And then you said what do you do as a player? So as a player, I think I like the idea that there's a possibility as an overlay, but it also makes no difference to me that there's an overlay because, yeah, there's free money in the pot, but I was going there hoping to play for 25 grand anyway. So if there's an overlay, yeah, there are fewer players to beat to get to the same amount of money, but in the end, you still have to play pretty damn well to get through that field, whether it misses by 50 people or it surpasses it by 300. That's the other thing. If you go way past the guarantee, now you got to beat so many more people. So I'm hoping for like the guarantee to be just met or not met. You know what I mean? But at the same time, I don't really look at the guarantee. If I know that I'm playing for $1 million, that's really cool, and that's what I'll hope for. And I'll hope for an overlay. That way, you know, I'm playing fewer people for that money. But I know I still have to play very well and go on a pretty tremendous run to get to that money anyway. And I don't think 10 players fewer in the field is going to matter. So I don't know. It's a very difficult question, actually. It sounds simple. Yeah, okay. Everybody could just say, oh, we want a huge guarantee. We want 5 guys to show up. You know, that's a simple answer. But I want poker to succeed on all angles. I want these properties to not feel like they've wasted money. I want them to, you know, I want everybody to stay in business so they can keep playing there and everything. So I want one that won't sting the manager, but will make us happy too. So I think hitting the guarantee is fine.
All right, you probably don't believe this, but that was really a perfect answer.
Wow.
And the reason I think it's perfect is it illustrates how difficult this issue is, right?
Yeah.
Because with player, I mean, it's not that big a deal. Player, I mean, if you decide not to go to a tournament, you go to a tournament, I mean, it's not that big a deal, right? But from a management standpoint, these guys' butts are on the line, right?
Yeah.
So that's why we do guarantees, because a lot of our managers have found that if you don't put a guarantee on it, people don't come, because they're not going to come unless they know there's something to play for, right?
Right.
So then the question becomes, how big of a guarantee? You know, if you make it too small, then people laugh at it, and it's not effective, it doesn't get people there. You make it too big and you miss it, then your boss is all over you, because that money comes out of his hide, you know? And then as the tournament schedule gets ever more competitive now, those decisions are much harder to come up with and hit right. And the fact that if you ask players like you or me, the two players right now that have been talking about it, we can't really tell you what we care, what we think about it. You know, it's one of those, it's almost like the Supreme Court pornography thing. I don't know, I know when I see it.
Yeah,
and it's the same thing with this. You know whether somebody hit a home run when you see it, but you can't really counsel them clearly on which way to go. And so, I mean, this is a tough situation now because there are some rooms out there that have been very successful in guarantees. And by successful, I mean not just obliterating it, but putting headline-grabbing guarantees on events, doing really well. And then, now the challenge is, you would think that'd be a great thing, right? Then the challenge is next year is you got players wondering, hey, what are they going to do to top it? And so that's really where this question came out of is, is do we need to continue to raise the guarantee to continue to get that buzz, or is there some other things we could do, or just the fact that the prize pool is going to be massive, that the guarantee, keeping the guarantee even at a what was a hot headline popping last year and this year might be like, ooh, they didn't really do anything different. Is that a challenge for it? And there's no easy answer, obviously, as we just found out.
Yeah, no, and here's, when you first brought that part up at this discussion, I thought to myself, it's very difficult to keep up with the Joneses in any facet of life.
And in this instance, you're only going to get burned eventually if you every year raise it from the year before, because there's going to be a year where you can't meet it.
Well, and submission returns, right?
Yeah. Right. And then if you don't meet it and you don't beat it, then now you've disappointed the community, because every year you've gone up in this guarantee, and on the one year that you don't, or the year you don't put a guarantee on, now you're going to tick everybody off. So,
well, you get the bad publicity. Now people are going to say, that event's jumped the shark now, when it's probably still
a great event.
A great event that's just obliterating everybody else, but it's that expectation. That's, you know, you're putting an expectation in other people's minds as how big that event should be, rather than what the market is going to do.
Yeah,
right?
And you know the dailies always, when they put their little guarantees on them, they never change those. It's only the big events that they feel the pressure to put the... I would just keep the guarantee at what it is, unless it gets so ridiculous that, you know, you're getting a $400,000 prize pool every year and you have a community that's solid and you're the only game in town and you've put a $50,000 on it. Then it's like, okay, well, maybe we can put our necks on the line a little bit and make it $100,000, at least get the six-figure number up there or something of that nature. But if it's like you're guaranteeing $50,000 and you're getting $63,000, and then you guaranteed 60 and you're getting 63, you don't want to go, all right, let's try 65 or 70 next year, because you never know when the game's going to plateau in your area or whatever. And you're right, it's very difficult. And I don't know, I wouldn't want to be put in those positions. And you know, as tour owners now, it's tough. You know, they come to us and say, hey, should we put a guarantee on them? You know, I'm always of the mind of, hey, you know what, until you've proven, because this is a brand new thing, because a lot of times we're going to properties that don't have tours, and they don't have they haven't had a big tournament field or a big tournament business, and so they're trying to break into it with us. The first thing I would want to say to them is, hey, look, this is your first time out, you know, if you want to put a guarantee on it, you know, you have to know that there's a very good possibility you might not make that guarantee, and that will make people happy, but it might not make your bosses happy. So it depends on a lot of your situation and your market and stuff too.
Yeah, like I said, just a very difficult discussion.
Yeah.
All right, so here's another one that's much smaller, but also equally frustrating, I think, for some managers. I talked to Juan about the difference between money-added tournaments and guaranteed tournaments. And I think it's pretty self-explanatory, but in case it's not. A guarantee is when you say, hey, the prize pool is going to be $1,000, so if you don't get enough players, you're still going to pay $1,000 in the prize pool, right?
Right.
So players know it's going to be $1,000. Money added, you're not putting a guarantee on it, so you're not guaranteeing any prize pool, but the casino is already proactively putting money into the prize pool that is not going to be taken out by other people. It's, you know, if you get 100,000 people in the tournament, there's still the money added that the casino is putting in regardless.
Right.
So this one manager, he was just completely frustrated, and he's like, players look for the bigger number in the ad, right?
Yeah.
So if I could say a $500 added money added tournament versus a $1,000 guaranteed tournament, players are going to flock to the $1,000 guaranteed tournament, and I do not understand why. Because if that tournament hits the $1,000 guarantee, which it almost always does, that tournament offers no additional benefit to the player.
Exactly. Right? Yep.
Yeah. The only benefit to a guarantee to a player is knowing that that's going to be there, right? And then if you have an overlay, if people will get there, then the money's added. The money added, the casino's already saying, hey, I'm going to put money in, and so it doesn't matter how many people get there, there's an extra pool of money, even if it's smaller than the guarantee.
Right, it's like an guaranteed overlay of whatever that money is in entry
fees. That's a great way of putting it, yes.
I know that it is kind of perplexing. And the other thing, too, is what I'm wondering... Have you experienced that these, when they do the money added, is it coming from the casino or is it coming from the player fund?
No, it's coming from the casino.
It's definitely casino, right? Because you can't do that with the player fund, right?
Well,
or can you?
I don't want to say blanket that you can't. I mean, some jurisdictions you probably can.
Okay.
They probably can. It's possible that there is a jurisdiction or two or three out there that would allow you to take it from the player fund and put it in. But I wouldn't automatically, as a player, assume that money is coming from the player fund. My initial assumption would always be that the casino is just putting that money in for marketing funds.
Yeah, and that's what I thought too. I figured that was it. But all right, so from a player standpoint, I would love the money added, because that means not only are they sincere about putting money into this tournament, but no matter what happens, no matter what size that field is, you're playing in an overlay. Now, it may not be a huge one, but if you were playing in a $50 tournament and they added a grand, that's like them missing the guarantee, you know, by 20 people.
Yeah.
And so, to me, that's huge. Now, again, most of the time the money added is nominal, but most of the time that money is not a big tournament series either. It's a daily or
right. Well, let me give you a real-life example, because I think you're going down the right road here, and it might help folks to think about it. Let's use the $500 versus $1,000. A $500 money added versus $1,000, that's probably about a $50 buy-in kind of tournament.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, yeah. So, you know, at that point, that's like 10 ghost players that you don't have to get through and the money added versus the guarantee if you get, what's that, 20 players, I guess?
Yeah.
They've hit the guarantee and there's no overlay or no benefit to the players.
Exactly. So to me, I would rather have money in there in a real-world situation that I know that it's like a guaranteed overlay, and there's 10 ghost players there, rather than I'm facing a field of 20 to get to the same prize pool, or similar prize pool. So, but, you know, you talked about how the manager said all they want is they want to see that big number in the ad. You know, in that case, very rarely, I think there's one on the West Coast, maybe Oregon, where they add 50 grand to the prize pool.
Right.
And it's like, you're never going to see that. You know, you'll see it where it was 300 rooms in the United States alone, you know, 1 in 300 shot of getting a 50K added to the prize pool. You know, that just doesn't happen. So, you know, when they see that big number, then I think it's a different criteria for them to follow. They're thinking, okay, I want to make sure that if I'm going to hop on a plane or I'm going to make a three-hour drive, that I'm going to be playing for a lot of money, not just some nominal, you know, money added to the prize pool that means very little to me, because it's a 10-player overlay for a small prize pool rather than no overlay for a huge one.
So, right. Well, again, it's all relative. I would say the 500 versus 1,000 example we're talking about is your normal daily tournament kind of thing.
Right.
If you're talking about a $50,000 player money added, then I think you're talking what, $100,000 guarantee would be what you would compare it to.
Yeah.
So it's all relative at that point. So
that's some serious money added there, 50 grand.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think what's even more fascinating about this discussion for me is that, I mean, the money added just seems like such a bad idea from a casino standpoint, I think, right? Because you're putting money in. So, I mean, it's all part of marketing. I mean, I guess however you want to market your tournaments, you know, advertising is a cost, you know, printing of flyers is a cost, you know, comping or giving away seats that aren't coming from the player. Any of the stuff you do to get players in, I mean, there's a consideration of how it works, so you need to spend those dollars wisely. And to me, I've just never understood the pumping money straight into the prize pool. But here is a manager that likes it, and I know I've talked to other ones that actually like it. They really prefer the money added thing. And now they're frustrated because they're actually coming out of pocket for something that doesn't seem to be working, even though it should be something that the players prefer. And that is probably the most frustrating thing about being a manager from all the ones I talk to, is how do you educate players on making proper decisions, or making decisions that you know are their best interest when they're telling you, no, we want this.
Well, you do is you write about it in Annie Up magazine, and you hope that their players read it and that the managers promote our magazine and say, hey, pick up this thing. And then what they should do is they should take that article that we write that promotes it, and then they should frame it and hang it on the wall in their poker room. I can't tell you, back in the old days when I used to be a serious bowler and I had a bowling column with one of the major newspapers in Connecticut, I took the advantage of that. And when it was a slow month where there was no results or nothing coming up, I would write columns about typical, you know, falsehoods about bowling and turn them on their head and make people understand certain things about bowling where, you know, I don't need to get into what those topics are, but there were like three or four times where I would visit the bowling centers in the county and go there to talk to the manager or go to the bowl of tournament, and they would see me and they'd say, "Aren't you the guy?" And I'm like, "Yeah." And they'd go, "Come over here, come over here." And they'd grab me and they'd pull me over to the counter and they'd show on the wall my column was framed and on the wall, because explain to people, you know, people who just had all these preconceived notions about bowling or didn't understand something, he'd say, "Look at this." And every time somebody comes to me and asks me something, I go over and I put them, and they point into this story. And it was really humbling. I was really excited by that. But that's something I think that poker rooms could do, is when they see something in our magazine that benefits everyone and they understand it, because that's what we try to do when we write, say, our publisher's column, or when you used to write the business column for us once in a while too. Those are important things, and we try to keep it balanced because that's what we are. We're journalists. I think that's one way to convey to the players, hey, you know what, here's a look at it that you may not be taking, you know, or an approach or a viewpoint. So that's one thing they could do. They could promote it that way, you know. They could, you know, and also have their dealers talk about it, you know, start the conversations or whatever. But it is frustrating that, you know, both sides aren't always seen. You know, the players are always looking for their view rather than hey, if I kept that viewpoint, it would always benefit me. This place might not be here tomorrow. You know, I need to understand both sides of the coin. So,
and I think some of it is just your, you know, what you're used to. You know,
yeah, that's true too.
You know, if you've been drinking 2% milk for your whole life, and then the wife brings home skim milk one day, you're like, "What the hell is this?" And then 14 years of marriage later, you're like, "Oh my gosh, they had 2% milk on the buffet. I can't have that. I eat skim." And I think that's really it. Is it's just you get used to something. And let's be honest, I think this is the most frustrating thing, is poker players like the bitch, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You don't find a lot of happy poker players, unfortunately. And so when you change something, you know, unless it's like, here we're talking about free money, so I can't even say free money. The players are going to complain because it's just, you know, hey, it's a change and we don't like it. We like the way it's always been, even though they haven't taken the time. So I guess I'll bring it up on the show, one, because I kind of want to get some feedback from listeners that might be in markets that are struggling with this money added versus guarantee. But also, it's always a reminder to players that here's the internal discussions that managers have about it. So you can better understand it. You know, I'm not advocating one way or the other, but at least you just heard a good discussion on the merits of the two, and you might better understand when your local poker room ends up having the same conversation at some point.
Yeah, I mean, clearly this is a difficult subject. I mean, let me see here. We spent 22 minutes on this. You know what I mean? And that I mean, really, we usually spend 3 minutes or 5 minutes on a topic, but this is serious. I mean, this is something that, you know, you want to make sure everybody's happy, because if they're not, it could mean a manager's job if he doesn't hit that guarantee, and it could mean the end of your poker room if they keep losing money, you know, if they're making the wrong decisions. And at the same time, you want to make sure that you're traveling for something that's worth it, or getting up that day and getting out of bed for that, because, you know, so it's a very difficult subject, and it's something that deserves being addressed like that.
All right, now we'll have a little fun, because I did get a chance to play a tournament on this trip, and it's one of these things, now that I play the tournament, I'm almost like taking mental notes, because always something comes up that I think the nation's going to like, right?
Yeah.
And every once in a while, it's one of these things that just makes me chuckle, and I just kind of want to get from the table, walk away, and laugh out loud. So I was playing this tournament, and it was a re-entry tournament, as almost all of them are now.
Yeah.
And so the player next to me shoved with a set. I had an over set to it, had top set, called him, felted him. Yay me, right?
Yep.
The player gets up, re-enters. It was a small tournament, so we ended up being reseated in the same seat. So I played with this guy for a while, right? And I think he made a mistake in the shove with me, even though he had set over set. It was a set over set. I had a set, he had a pair. So it was even worse, yeah. Right. I didn't have a high degree of faith in his quality of play, right? So later on, he shoves with an underpair. I forget what the board was, but he had like pocket fours or fives or something small, right?
Right.
And he gets called by a player who had top pair, top kicker. That hand holds up. This player's felted for the second time, or thin. I forget what it was. And he grumbles, and then out loud he's like, "You know what? Some players are just bad." And I wanted to say, you know, again, being very polite, having any of colors on, but my answer would be, yes, you are bad. You are the bad player.
Please re-enter.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, you know, it's one of these things where I get, we're always upset when we get felted, right? We always get upset, particularly when we make a move. Because that's what initially the guy said. As soon as the other guy turned over his cards, he's like, "Oh, I thought you were just trying to buy the pot. And I thought my shove was going to get you off." He's like, "Wow, that's really loose call with top pair." So, I mean, he's upset that he misread the hand, right? And then upset that he lost the hand. And I get it. You want to blow off steam. But I don't get this thing where we have to feel like we have to criticize somebody else's play, particularly in a game of poker. I mean, there's so few situations, I think, where it's clear that one player made a huge mistake.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there's so many things going on. You know, you've got history with these players. You've got other considerations that you may not think of. There are other considerations that you may not agree with. But everybody's played the game one way or the other. So I mean, just to come out and say, "You're bad because you called my bluff," it's really kind of funny to me, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Because you just never know what's going through someone else's mind. Or, you know, there are times where, like, I think you even mentioned where you don't even see the flush because you're so intent on the straight cards that came that it went runner, runner, flush. Or, you know, they're just, you don't know what someone's mindset is.
Crazy.
Yep, absolutely crazy.
All right, so the other funny at this the table, we are down to two tables left. One of the players at our table goes on an absolute torrid run. He was just busting people left and right. He had stacks and checks, you know, all that, right? Player says, "Man, if this guy doesn't cash, I'm quitting poker." And we all chuckle because we're like, "Yeah, there's no way this guy is going to cash." He didn't cash! Final table, he gets set over set against the chip leader.
Oh wow!
Without cashing. So, folks, it can happen.
So don't quit.
Exactly. So, you know, of course, I'm the short stack ninja as always, right? So this is the kind of stuff that I live for at the file table, because I played really well, had a big stack for a while, just couldn't find the right spots later on, so my stack dwindled a little bit. So I was obviously a short stack going to the final table, top four cash in this tournament, right? So this is kind of where my short stack ninja mindset goes. At that point, at this point, I don't have enough chips to really still honestly pretend that I can win this tournament, right? You know, because everybody's like, "Oh, you're going to play to win. Don't play to cash." Yeah, all right, that's fine. But when you have, like, six chips in front of you, I guarantee you cashing is a great goal to have, right?
That's right.
So at that point, so then your object, I think, is to hope for these kind of situations, right? Yeah, you can never sit there and just hope for set over set with chip leader versus number two in chips, right? But the fact that that possibility exists is good for you, because this player, by all rights, should have cashed. And now he's out, and I'm still in with a chance to cash. And that's huge, right?
Yeah.
And it doesn't have to be anything that nefarious. Is you just have to wait for somebody to make a move at some point, get called by some mid-board ships, and lose. And then you move up a spot, right?
Yeah.
So that's kind of the strategy when I'm in this situation. That's what I was doing here. Except this tournament, I had a momentary bout of insanity, and it cost me a possibility of cashing. We were six left, top four cash, right?
Yeah.
And one of the things that I do earlier in tournaments, and I don't know why I thought I had to do it here, is I look for, particularly when I'm going to shove, I'm looking for cards that I have a good degree of faith that are alive and have opportunities. So, for example, in this hand I had 10-8 of hearts. Mm-hmm. All right, so I'm going to assume that my 10 or 8, if I hit it, is probably going to be good by somebody that calls me, right? Generally, if I'm going to shove there, I'm going to assume it's going to be like a king-jack or ace-queen or something like that that's going to call me. You're going to be right. I'm not excited about that. But I'm going to assume that my cards are live. Plus, I have the suits working for me. Plus, I have the straight working for me. Mm-hmm. That seems to be one where I have a lot of insurance where I can shove and hopefully pick up the blinds, which at that point is really what I want to do, is pick up the blinds and survive another round and hope for some more of this magic to happen, right? Mm-hmm. But in this situation, my two strategies butted heads, and it was stupid. There's absolutely no reason for me, I don't think, if I'm wrong, there's absolutely no reason for me to shove with 10-8 suited, short stacked, when I was under the gun and I had enough chips to survive the blinds and get another round in. Am I wrong?
Well, to quote your friend, some players are just bad. Yes, you're bad. I don't know. You know, here's the deal. Maybe you would get called by those two types of hands you described. And the other thing, too, is when you say you had plenty of chips to survive those blinds, did you really have plenty of chips?
Yeah, I had enough.
See, that's scary, because the odds of someone going set over set and you losing another player that's significant at that table, I mean, it happens so rarely that when it happens in front of you, you have to think it's not going to happen again for 6 months.
But here's the deal, though. We're six now. It's not like when, you know, we're at the final table, we get to the final table, we were 10-handed to top four cash. I'm going to make that move quite a lot of time. At that point, I'm still so far away from the money, right, that I'm going to have to chip up, and I'm going to have to get lucky to do it. But when I get out of the six-handed, there's a very real possibility that if I could afford the blinds, and the blinds weren't going to cripple me, but, I mean, obviously, I was playing with one leg at that point, right?
Yeah.
That is another five hands I was going to see. And not only five hands I'm going to see, but five hands that other player at the table is going to see. And no one was as short stacked as I was, so I couldn't really count on anybody else. This would have been an even a worse mistake had other people been as short stacked as I was. But there were some players there that I think, had they got a hand, that they probably would have shoved. And we had enough huge stacks at the table that they could call almost anybody at the table and survive losing the hand. So someone's going to call them. And I just needed two more of the six people at the table to go out. And I could have got at least five more hands. And then, as long as you keep doubling up, you could be there all day, right? So that's kind of my strategy in this. And, you know, had we been eight-handed or ten-handed, I don't think I'd even be talking about it on the show right now. But the fact that I did it when we were six-handed is really sad in my stomach.
Yeah, okay. I was trying to make you feel better. But really, though, the thing about it, too, is when the other players look over and see you so short-stacked and the blinds coming at you
right. The
next hand, that if you didn't play that 10-8, they might have folded, too, saying, hey, this guy's going to be in the blinds next two hands. He has to shove the next two hands. They don't know you're the short-stacked ninja. They think that you're just every other player who just, hey, I'm in the blinds. I got a face card. I'm shoving. So if they think that you're going to shove on the next two hands, then they're not going to play their two hands. So that gets you to that point. So now you don't really have those legitimate five hands that, you know, you, in your mind that you think you're going to get. You're actually getting maybe three hands, of which you just folded one of them, you know, and you're going to be in the blinds again because six-handed. Now it's like, all right, yeah, there's also that perception that you have to remember. It's not just you. You're not playing by yourself in a vacuum. People are looking at your stack and thinking the same thing, that you're going to probably shove, so why play a hand when I don't have to, when I know I'm going to at least get this guy out, and then I'm going to be one away from the money, and I'm not truly desperate yet. So you have to remember what they're thinking, too.
Right. And I guess, you know, the more I think about the whole short-stack ninja thing was probably developed because I played a ton of sit-and-goes back, you know.
Yeah, the ship.
There's just so much poker stars. even on the ship, too.
Right.
Just, and that strategy is so much different than multi-table. And really, in sit-and-goes, it was always about the math and where people were. And, you know, because no one had a ton of chips. And so you're picking spots rather than playing poker. And I probably let that bleed too much into my multi-table game, which... And that's where I found it to be effective, though, is because, as you said, Jim, you're right. Most of those players are thinking that. They are going to think that, because in their mind, when they get short-stacked, they just shove with anything. And see, an ace, I'm in.
Yeah.
King, I'm in. And I don't do that. In fact, actually, I fold, you know, naked aces in that situation, because when I get called, it's probably going to be by somebody with a bigger ace, and I'm not going to be live to one of my cards. So I would rather shove with 5-7 or 10-8 or something like that where I'm live. And I'm willing to stick it out there and get down to four or five chips, you know, if I know I just need to wait for somebody else to get out. And then once I get the money, then that's a different story at that point. Then you're back into the trying to win it, even though your odds are pretty high at that point.
But absolutely.
It's a big difference between $100 and no dollars,
that's right.
You know, in a $50 tournament.
Especially
right?
when you're on the road.
Yeah, exactly. All right, well, that was a good talk. So, but yeah, we got more stuff from the show, from the trip next week that I think will be interesting. But those were two things from this trip this week.
Cool. All right, each week we spotlight a listener who called our hotline at 206-338-6344 or emails us at podcast@antiupmagazine.com. And if they haven't won something from us in the past year, just like we do with Call the Floor and Hand of the Week, we send them something fantastic. This week's sponsor is Smapsoft, creator of the Chinese 13-card poker app for Apple products. Download the app today by visiting the iTunes store. And it comes from E. Hunt. He says, while listening to your commentary about the poker economy on recent podcasts, I realized a friend of mine does something similar in the way of giving back to the money pool. However, his is more deliberate and focused. He usually has the games he plays in beat before he sits down, meaning he's very good and they're not. He tries to win a modest amount each time and never really huge. This means he'll take a couple of ill-advised gambles late to dump, and that's our Hunt's term here, not the guy I'm saying himself. So he'll dump back into the game before cashing out. I have a moral issue with this and have debated with him many times, telling him I strongly disagree with that method. I think you should always play your best, and playing poorly when you know you're making a bad decision is just another form of cheating. He doesn't play favorites with whom he loses to, but after watching a couple of times in the past, he does seem to give back to those that he takes from more than anybody else. His side of the argument is he still has an overall profit, and since it's a home game, he wants everybody to have a good time, feel good about themselves, and he wants to keep getting invited back. What do you think, Scott?
All right. Well, I'm glad he wrote in, because I had another listener wrote in about this discussion I had, and no surprise, I did not do a good job of explaining my position and left at least two listeners confused, and probably more, right?
Right.
And so that other listener, I was able to write back very succinctly what I was trying to convey, and she wrote back, oh, excellent, makes sense. So what you're trying to say is not feeding the fish, but restocking the pond. And I'm like, yes, that's it, because feeding the fish really would be the socialism thing that people can't get past of all this income inequality discussion we had, right? Yeah. And that's where people get upset. And that's not what I was suggesting. That's what I was suggesting is, you know, hey, you teach some poker classes or you encourage people to get into the game, whatever. You want to keep restocking the pond, right? So I think what our listener's friend here is doing – I think it's different than the discussion we're having. It's similar, but different enough. He's just trying to make sure that these particular fish keep coming back and are happy. And that way, so he's always doing his own form of socialism here, where he's just like, you know what? I'm going to make sure that some of this money I'm taking out, I'm giving back so they come back next week. And to the larger discussion that we had a couple weeks ago, that's not at all what I was suggesting to other people was. I think our listener's friend here would do better to, you know, take some time after the game to explain to someone some strategy, or, you know, in a way that doesn't offend him or something. That would probably be more to the point that I was making a couple weeks ago. Now, to this point, this is where it gets to the whole poker's not black and white, it's shades of gray, in my opinion.
Right.
You know, black and white, yes, this is not good. You should be playing your best at all times, and it's unfair to the other players if you're dumping to one and not to the other. Even if you're trying to make a conscious decision to dump to everybody equally, you can't really do that, right? Because you can't control what other people are doing in the situations. But the shade of gray here, to me, is that I don't think this guy is obviously not doing it to be nefarious or to hurt the game. He's doing it, in his mind, to help the game. And it's a home game. He's trying to keep it friendly. He's there. People are having a good time. So, you know, if he makes a little bit of profit and then gives it a little bit back to people so they're having a good time and want to come back next week, I would be hard-pressed to call him a criminal for doing that. I would prefer that he found other ways of doing it, but I am not as I'm not a black and white on this issue. Or really any issue. So I guess that's what I would say.
Yeah, I'm not either. I'm reminded of the scene in The Matrix, because everything comes back to The Matrix, when Agent Smith is sitting there with Morpheus, and he says to him, hey, you know what I hate about humans? He says, you're like a virus, and you go to one area of the world, and you take all the resources, And then when you've depleted those resources completely, you leave that area decimated and ruined and can never anything ever happen again. You don't coexist like animals do. You kill everything and you move on like a virus. And you're in this game here. If you were to go there every single week and annihilate that game, they're not going to invite you back. And do you want to make money? Do you want to, you know, it's like, you know.
Well, or you might kill the game altogether.
Or kill the game altogether because you've taken all their money. And now you've affected, let's say there's four guys in the game with you or five. You've affected five guys getting together every Friday or whatever. And you've taken all their money, so they can't get together anymore. They resent that you've, you know, I mean, there's a lot of reasons to at least consider doing something like that. And this isn't, believe me, this isn't the first time this topic has come up. We've seen it, you see it in movies and on TV, and you hear about it and you read about it in books where they say, you know, you don't want to kill the fish. You know what I mean? You want to make sure that they can continue to thrive in that community, and you can keep going there and catching a fish to eat that day. You know, if you go in there and you kill all the fish at once, you'll eat for like a king for that little bit at a time, but the next season you're not going to be able to eat again. You're going to starve. So, to me, I don't have any problem with it if he's doing it in a, you know, in a good way. I'm like you. I don't see, this isn't black and white for me. There's just no way that I would go to this game, annihilate it, and keep annihilating it until there's no money left or until they don't invite me back. Then what have I accomplished? Oh, now I have to go try to find another game when everyone's happy, when he's doing what he's doing. Everyone's happy. Who cares?
Yeah, it's definitely a slippery slope, but everything in life is a slippery slope, and you got to figure that out. We do try to edit these letters down so we don't spend a lot of time reading. And I feel bad that the one thing I did edit out of this is I believe the other players at the table in this game know that this player is better than them. And they come up to him afterwards and say, hey, we know you are light years ahead of us in terms of poker knowledge. So to me, that goes back to my original thing. I mean, if the players are coming to you and saying, gosh, you're really good, and almost in a way of, hey, we respect you for your skills, I think at that point it's almost it's much easier to do what I would suggest is, you know, hey, you know, come here early next week or stay late a week after, and we can just talk about some concepts and point out some flaws or that. And that's essentially helping those players in a way that's not messing with the integrity of the game, which is what our listener is upset about.
Yeah.
And that's probably a better way of going about it, if possible. I mean, sometimes you'd be in a game and you know how egos, poker players have egos, and they're not going to be willing to admit that somebody at the table is better than them and that they can learn anything from them. And at that point, then you're kind of stuck on your options. But it sounded to me from the original letter that this is a situation where this player had an opportunity or has an opportunity going forward to help the game in ways that don't violate the integrity of the game.
Yeah, and I don't want to extend this any longer because the show's already getting long, but just real quick, I mean, let's open up another scenario where have you ever played in a game where your buddy or anybody, because they're all your buddies in a home game, where they're having a really bad day, they're down to like, let's say you bought it for 100 and they're down to 18 and you're playing No Limit Hold'em and he shoves and you look down at like 4-4 and you're like, you know what, I'll give you a shot, you know, to try to double up or whatever. And, you know, you're doing it because, you know, your buddy wants to double up. You've got mountains and mountains of stats because you happen to have a good day that day. You know, there are times where people call because they're not calling to put you out of your misery. They're calling that maybe you'll double up and go on a run or something. Or there are it's a home game. You know, you're friendly. You know, the last home game I hosted, there was an opportunity where I got it all in with someone in PLO. I had pocket aces that were suited, and the player had pocket aces and some other things working with it, maybe Broadway. And I just said, hey, you want to just chop it now? Because no one wants to suffer that bad beat for no reason in a home game that's friendly where, yeah, okay, we'll try to take your money, but there's also a chance that you're not going to make that money too. So there are reasons to be friendly in a home game, and if it's that he's dumping chips to them, well, okay, maybe there's some sort of conundrum there in your mind that, you know, okay, the integrity of the game or whatever. But really, when you're playing in a home game, it's more about everyone having a good time and making some money. And yeah, we try to take each other's money in our home game, of course, and we love it when we do, but I also don't want to bust Scott so bad or have him bust me so bad that we're upset and don't play anymore or whatever. So you got to take a lot of it with a grain of salt.
Absolutely. I don't know if that really helps our listener trying to figure out what to do there, but at least maybe it helps them not let a sentence crawl as much.
No, you're right. You're absolutely right.
All right, if you find yourself in a situation in your favorite poker room or home game and not sure what the proper ruling should have been, email us at podcast@antiupmagazine.com and we'll have Antiup Poker Tour Tournament Director Salmon to tell you how he would have ruled in our Call to Florida segment. This week comes from Anonymous, written some of the great books of society, and now he's writing into here.
Great quotes, too. A lot of great quotes from Anonymous. He's
absolutely.
Yeah.
All right, so he says, can you provide an example of, quote, the seat will have the big blind twice when balancing tables?
Okay, Sam says, I have never seen a scenario where a player posts a big blind and then is moved from the small blind to another table to post a big blind. The rule when balancing tables is to take the player from the worst position and move them into the worst position on the new table. The small blind is never the worst position on the table. When you have just paid the big blind, you are safe and should never be moved to another table to pay the big blind again. If this has happened to you, it's definitely not the correct move.
Yeah, I totally agree. You know, one of the things where it gets tricky is when tables break, though.
Right.
And I think some players forget that. When you're being picked up by a tournament director and moved to another spot, that should happen. I would give the, but if the table breaks, it is quite possible that you will pay the big blind twice.
Yeah.
You know, because at that point, it's a luck of the draw. It's not a tournament director picking you up and physically put you in the seat and saying, yes, you need to play the big blind twice.
Right.
So I think that might happen sometimes that people get confused by it. Because, you know, every time the table breaks, it's down, I just paid the big blind. Well, yeah. Great. Welcome to poker.
Yeah.
The other scenario, I have seen this at times, though. I mean, balancing tables is really difficult, and particularly late in a tournament when players are short stack and people are busted all the time. So, and as soon as you get like short stack or short players at the table, everybody's, we're playing sixth handed over here, and they demand quick action, right? And a good tournament director will be probably on top of it trying to make it quick. But if you go and pick a player up and then you get over there, like three other people get knocked out or something like that, it gets really difficult at that point. So I'm not saying that that's a justification for if the scenario ends up with you playing twice, but understand what the tournament director is trying to do, and if there's not a good reason for why you're playing the blind twice, then speak up. But sometimes, it, I imagine, it does happen. But clearly, it should not on purpose ever happen.
All right, we get to complete O'Malley's move today. We'll remind ourselves with part one here. Here we go.
Hello, and welcome to another O'Malley's Move. I'm Malcolm O'Malley. We're still in that 10-20 game, and we're sitting with our original buy-in of 2,000 after losing a heartbreaker to a turn straight. On this hand, the under-the-gun limps, plus one calls, MP1 min raises to 40. Yep, these even happen at this level. And we're in the hijack with the 8 of diamonds, 7 of diamonds. This is a perfect hand to call a min-raise with, so we do. The cutoff calls, the button folds, small blind folds, big blind calls, under the gun and the plus one call, and we're going to a flop with 240 in the pot. The flop is the 10 of hearts, 9 of spades, 5 of diamonds. And interestingly enough, it's checked to us. We're going to make a stab at it. If it gets called, we can shut it down unless a 6 or a jack comes on the turn. We make it 150 to go. The cutoff calls, but everybody else folds. This is the same player from our heartbreaker. Now he's got position on us, and he's got us covered. The turn is the jack of diamonds. With 540 in the pot, we've hit one of our gin cards. And it gives us a flush draw, though we don't care too much about that. We lead out for 300. Our opponent raises us to 900. So, we've invested 490 into this pot. What's the move here?
We have the shove, don't we? We have the third nuts. I think we could dismiss queen 8. That seems wildly improbable. King queen would probably be the most likely here, but that seems like a way loose call with a gut shot and two overs to the fact that we bet on the flop on this thing, right? So I'm thinking we're good, but if I'm wrong, we do have the flush backup, so we do have insurance. But either way, we have just 1,500 in our stack, and I love to say just 1,500.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know when I've ever just had 1,500 in my stack. But our options are fold or shove now because of that, because of the money we put in and the bet we're facing now. So I can't fold a straight here when I got flush backup. So I think that means I have to shove.
Okay, I don't know if it's possible, but I think I couldn't disagree with you any more than I...
Awesome, love it!
And here's the deal, if I disagree with you, then we get to have, you know, someone's right, someone's wrong kind of thing, and whatever. But I felt that King-Queen was a very plausible hand here, because he could... First of all, let's eliminate the fact that it's 10-20, because...
Well, I already did that, right?
We can't think about it like that. Let's say it was 10-cent, 20-cent. If somebody, you know, if somebody bet $1.50 to you and you had 10, 12 bucks in front of you in a 10-cent, 20-cent game, and you were in position on that person who, you know, we're not exactly sure they have a hand here, they could have anything because they were in a, you know, they weren't actually raising preflop or whatever. Would you consider playing the person, what you're supposed to do in this game, and not the situation? So you might particularly take these cards and float with them. I have no reason not to think that with two overs and a gut shot to the nuts, and if I had the same two diamonds that you did, I could possibly consider floating for 150 there when I'm playing in a big game like this, because 150 doesn't mean anything to me. It's not that big of a deal.
Yeah.
And then if he checks the turn, now I've got him. If I've missed, if I've hit, now I'm in the driver's seat. So I don't see King Queen as a hand that I can see that hand to me. You thought it was kind of it could be the hand that would do this kind of thing.
It's a loose call,
but it's a loose. Yeah. It is a loose call, but again, it's a loose call if you're playing just the cards. If you're playing person, I felt like that was a really good hand. The other hand I thought of was 9-10 of diamonds, which we are screwed against if the diamonds get there. And he also has outs to a boat and could play it this way. So we have a third nuts. That person who called us could already have the nuts, and we could be drawn dead to that because he could have the king, queen of diamonds, or he could have the 9-10 of diamonds and drawing to a better flush or a boat. So I think I might call. I don't know if I would fold. I might fold if I got that feeling. If I got that feeling.
Okay. So everything you said is great. And you're right. It's very possible that he could be floating here. But so this comes down to... This is why I don't think you can call, right? I didn't put it in the notes, but I figured it out. We have what? We put in, let's see, 40, 190. We put in about 500 bucks to the pot already, right?
Right, which is why you said we have 1,500.
So we have 1,500 left.
Right.
And now we're facing about a 600 more, right?
Right.
Which would leave us with 900 left.
Right.
So if you call, we're out of position, what are you looking for on that river? And the reason I'm asking this is because we have the best straight that we possibly can get right now, right?
Right, we do, yeah, for us, right.
If we can hit the diamonds, obviously our hand and hand ranks improves, but I don't know whether we like that or not, but maybe you do. I mean, and I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm just trying to get a feeling. If you call, what are you looking for on the river? Or are you just giving yourself that Scott Long option of folding on the river and saving this if you just the feeling just isn't there?
Well, again, here's the deal. If the diamond comes, okay, and the guy has 9-10 diamonds, now he may think you called with a bigger flush draw, and he might check behind and be happy he hit it because he had his two pair and backed into a flush draw. If he has the straight and he doesn't have the diamonds, we might just be able to get away with checking the river and him checking behind because he only has king queen for a straight, and we have that 900 in our pocket, and we actually make and win the pot. There are some scenarios I think where it would check behind here on us. I'm just thinking that if the diamond gets there and he had small diamonds, he might check behind. If a diamond gets there and he doesn't have any diamonds, he will check behind, and I'll be happy with the pot because there's so many unknown factors here right now. I just feel like King Queen is a plausible hand, and so is 9-10 of diamonds. Now it's very specific, and you're really narrowing the range, but I'm giving you at least two hands, and even your Queen 8 is possible. It's not likely, but a Queen 8 is possible too. So I would want. I think a call is okay here because you still have 900 left, and there's a chance that you hit your diamond and you check it, hoping that this guy will bet not having the flush, and you could just call again, or that'll check behind. You have 900 left. If this guy shoves on the end on a blank, then you can maybe fold, maybe, if you get that feeling again. But to me, $900, it's shoving, because the other thing is, when you said to, in your first description, you said that king-queen was unlikely, and queen-eight was unlikely, was very wildly improbable. So why are we shoving then? If we think that there's no way anybody has a hand that beats us, what's the point of shoving? So why would I shove over this guy who raised me if I think I'm good? Why not just call? Because you're hoping he doesn't hit another card on the end to beat you? I would never shove there. I would fold or call.
All right.
Given what you said, especially.
All right. So if you call, then you're not anticipating putting any more money in this pot. You're going to call with the intention of hoping that he checks behind on the river.
Well, hoping that he does. But if he puts out a value bet of like 350 or 400, which he might, because all he did was raise us on the turn, he's not going to bet another 900. He might just bet 300 on the river. I still have 600 left.
Gotcha.
You know, I wouldn't mind calling a value bet on the end with a straight. I can't fold a straight there for a value bet. But if he shoves, then I have to reassess again. But at least I'm giving myself that shot. If I just shove and he's got the nuts, I'm drawn dead, especially if it's king, queen of diamonds. I don't like just shoving there. It feels like a tournament move rather than a cash game move. But I could be wrong, too. I have no idea.
Very interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't think it was going to be that interesting until we started talking about it. All right, let's see what happens. Part two.
Hello again. There are two hands that beat us here. King-queen and queen-eight. And unless the king-queen is suited in diamonds, we have outs to that one. Additionally, I don't see this opponent calling our flop bet with either of these hands. This could be a draw or a myriad of other hands. Either way, I think we're ahead of the range that he could have. We shove. Our heart drops as we see that our opponent can't get his chips in fast enough, and we see the bad news. He really called our flop bet with king-queen offsuit? A black eight falls on the river, and we can't afford a rebuy. Until next time, I'm Malcolm O'Malley saying, if you're not uncomfortable, you're not playing poker. But remember, don't be an idiot about it. I wish I wasn't. Back to the 1-2 tables. I hope to see you on the felt.
All right, no doubt better players than me and O'Malley would have folded on that turn or to a river shove. Chris sends a big one of them.
Yeah.
But that's why you want me and O'Malley at that on that wall.
You need me on
at that table. Especially if I play King Queen off light.
Yeah, you know,
the floating thing is one of those things that I haven't developed in my game as much as I should. I know that's a powerful play. I understand it for whatever reason. I just never embraced doing it, so I'm not as used to seeing it and identifying it when it's happening as other players. So, and you're probably right. That's probably exactly what happened here.
Yeah, I mean, it just feels like whenever I listen to O'Malley, I try to remove the money from it and think, all right, or put it in a smaller stake. So would I have called $1.50? Yeah, probably. With two overs, a gut shot, and I don't know how this guy plays, or I'm in position on him, and if he just checks the turn, what would he be checking the turn with unless he was weak, and then I could steal it from him. And in this case, I ended up hitting my gin card and taking you for a ride. I just don't see the shove there. Why lose 900 for no reason, you know, when you could lose 350 or 450 or something? So,
well, I mean, that's been the best part of the discussion, I think, is you're right. I went back over, when you mentioned that, I went back over and thought about it, and you're right. It doesn't make any sense for me to shove at that point with the way I've analyzed the hand.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing, too, is I'm always at an advantage because you set up the file for us when we do these shows, and you have to answer first. And so I read what you say, and I have a chance to think about that as well. So it's not exactly fair that I get to do that all the time. So that's, you know, another reason why.
Life's not fair, but I think that it's good that I mean, the reason we do this kind of stuff on the show with this and the hand of the week is the way we do it is because this is not we're using liberties that we don't get to at the at the table.
Yeah, right.
And obviously, I mean, if you're looking at it in a straight line, like. you know, hey, guys, we never have this much time at the table to make a decision. I don't think you're ever going to get better at that point. I mean, I think that's kind of like in cross country, those are like the sprints you do like the day before the race.
Yeah.
That just give you that extra edge. But really, the fact that we're having these discussions in a forum that is not realistic, it's less about the specific hand and more about related hands going forward.
Yeah, and the more repetition you do it, the more it comes to you immediately at the table. Just like, you know, now everyone knows that when you have an open and a straight draw, you have 8 outs. But in the beginning, when you first started playing, if you didn't know that, you'd have to think to yourself, okay, there are 4 threes and there are 4, you know, whatever. So,
right.
You know, it's just with these kind of experiences, you keep doing them over and over again, they're going to come to you automatically eventually. And this is just something that, you know, floating is a big part in the limit hold'em.
Well, I think this is, I think O'Malley said this is the last of the 10-20 game.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Yeah, because he has no more money.
Exactly.
He's busted out. Now. He busted out of it.
I think we're back to next week, so O'Malley's people will probably be, I'm at a nickel dime game. The local senior center.
This is Joe Navarro, and you're listening to the best poker cast in all the universe, Ante Up, the absolute best on poker.
Okay, it's time for Hand of the Week. Send your hands or situations to podcast at antiupmagazine.com. This week we have a situation from Todd Faustin, who writes it very often. It always has something interesting to say. So let me give you a little background on this. And then normally as our situation, I will just read the whole thing, and then we can discuss the situation as a whole, because I think there are a couple interesting considerations here that we come up with. All right, so he was playing in a $40 buy-in, 1-2 low limit hold'em cash game out in the L.A. area. And specifically said because the low stakes tables had the best view of the big screen TVs of the NFL playoff games.
I think I played in that game. I think I played that game out there.
You know, some people, the game selection comes down to who's at the table, how many stacks there are. But, you know, the view of the TV, yeah. I do think, is an important consideration.
Especially if you've got sports betting going on.
Yeah, well, a $40 buy-in, too. I mean, you can't get hurt too hard. Yeah. All right, so he said a new table that just opened up. He said, I lost one buy-in early as one particular player ended up with a very large, relative to the stakes, several hundred chip stack. As the session wore on, however, it was obvious that he played way too many hands. Mid-buy players came and went and were often busted by his aggressiveness and luck. He also intimidated weaker players into just folding way too many times. I knew my chances of a big pot would be best played against him because he would guarantee action if I had cards and I was willing to play.
Okay.
My second buy-in fueled me back to even as I soon doubled, and eventually I had more than doubled, covering both buy-ins and then some to a stack of about 235 or so. Now, I was mid to late position when I looked at a king, six of spades, and limped for $2. He says, I limped only because of the position and the fact that the table's two big stacks, a newcomer who had won a few pots but had me covered, and Mr. Aggression, both were the blinds. The flop saw four to a flush. Small blind made a $20 bet, which the big blind raised to 40. And I figured I'd be getting at least 2-1 on my money as about a 40% or so favorite. But I thought if I could see the cards for a little pot control, I might save a little. So I called the $40 and I'll die on blind players folded. Small blind, however, shoved all in and was instantly called by the big blind. Using the same logic as above, except for the cheap part, I pushed all in too. The turn card was the ace of spades, giving me the nut flush. The most never made it. I can't remember what the river was. As it turns out, he says, I used the attached online calculator. You should be able to ski grab, which people can't see at home, of course. But it says I was 43% to win the hand post-flop. So he wants to know, would you have had the ace in your hand to make this call, or would you have ever been in this situation? I suspect you're going to say that no, King 6 is never in your range, and this hand could make you go broke more often than not.
Well, this is really weird. I actually was playing at Treasure Island in Las Vegas on one of the trips I went out there by myself. And I had – it might have been King 8 of hearts. And I was very similar situation where on the trip I was down like 300. Maybe – it might have been like I was down 300. And the table was pretty good but not that good. But there were two players at the table who were clearly better than I was. And I had an opportunity where something very similar to this happened, where I had like king eight of hearts, I was on the button, and it might have been like one guy raised a 10 and like five callers. And I'm saying, whoa, you know, I'm in position with king eight of hearts. It's not a really good hand, but if an ace of heart flops and, you know, 10 to win 60 already or whatever it was. So I got involved in the hand for the same reason, thinking, God, I could double through these guys. I had 300 in front of me. And flop came with two hearts, but and it wasn't the ace of hearts. The ace of hearts wasn't out there. And it went like bet, raise, shove, call. And I look down and I'm like, if I win this pot, I'm going to win like 1600 or something. And I just had to do it. And I called. And I, because the shove was more than me. The guy had like 450 or something. And I probably shouldn't have done it. I don't know. But I was looking at it like, hey, I've got the second nut flush draw here. And I might have actually hit a king too, or an eight or something. I might have hit the eight. So I thought to myself, whoa. There's no reason. I can make a lot of money on this hand. Do I take a chance here? It's not maybe the best play optimally or whatever. I could be drawing dead, you know, because somebody could have a set and someone else could have the ace of hearts or another heart. Who knows? But I went for it and it didn't get there. I lost. The flush never got there. Nobody had the ace of hearts, but the flush never got there. I think I ended up just having a pair of eights. And, of course, lost. So instead of being even or way up for the trip, I was actually down like six at that point. And so I saw it from my end as I can make a bunch of money. And I didn't. I didn't make a bunch of money, and it cost me. And getting it all in with a flush draw, it's one of the times that, you know, Scott likes to say, oh, Kassoon's always gets it all in with it. And I used to always do that, but I've actually cut back on it. And that was one of the reasons why, because I lost a ton of money on a and just really flipping a coin, hoping that I would make a bunch of money rather than making the best play possible at the table. So would I have limped with that queen, king six? Probably not. I probably wouldn't have limped with that king six. I probably would have let it go. And I think you've even talked about that in the past, Scott, how when you first started learning poker, you would play a suited king.
Every suited king.
Yeah, every suited king. And it's just a bad play to make.
Brutal.
Because especially in this situation, he got lucky, but one of those two players easily could have had a suited ace, and you'd have been drawn dead.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things is, this is something I see a lot, I think, is when you're at a table with an aggressive player that's just running over the table, I think the human reaction to that is to loosen up and try to get a win. Really tightening up is really the way to go, but that's just so frustrating because, you know, with this guy is in every pot and pushing people around, you want that chance to bust them so badly. Right, so the tight up, it just almost it's even more frustrating than just playing your normal game, and I don't know for sure, but I'm going to guess that's kind of what Todd fell into here, is that, you know, I'm looking for any opportunity to bust this guy. This is a suited king. You know, if I flop spades here, he's going to give me action, and I'm going to bust him. And I just don't think that's the way to go, because I think his concern here was, you know, one of the questions he's asked, he's like, would you make this move unless you had the ace of spades? And I think I would say I would need the ace of spades, but I would feel a lot more comfortable playing for stacks right now on a draw if I knew I was drawn to the nut flush and not the second nut flush, particularly in a three-handed pot.
Yeah.
Because as it turns out, I guess I didn't go over this, but the small blind, which is the one that shoved, had the board is queen of spades, jack of hearts, nine of spades. The small blind, which eventually shoved, had queen of diamonds, nine of clubs for top and bottom pair. The aggressive player had the two red aces, so really had nothing other than overpair.
Yeah.
So using the calculation, the queen nine was the slight favored, 43.96% to win. We were just behind at 43.08%, and the aces obviously were the dark horse at 12.96. So I could definitely see the small blind shoving here, although it's a kind of a dangerous board because somebody could have king 10, particularly in a limp pot, right?
Right.
Or even, I guess, 8-10. I mean, who plays 8-10?
That's the other thing, too, I didn't know, was that he could have made a straight, you know, because we didn't know the flop, which
exactly
enhances the reason to do something, maybe, but...
It gives you an option for a 10 to chop if somebody has it at that point. Or in this case, I mean, Ted would have won it for him as well, too.
Yeah,
so a little extra bonus. But, I think in that situation, and a table like this, because, again, you're playing, you know, it's a $40 buy-in, and you've worked hard to get your two buy-ins, right, and work it up to $235. That's a pretty good day at the office for a $40 buy-in. And if it doesn't say specifically, but if I remember in California, I think this is probably just a straight $40 buy-in. I don't think you get an option of buying it for more. I could be wrong. But if that's the case, then, you know, if you have to build it back up for 40, then that's a big deal to risk $235 on a hand when you know you're behind. I don't think there's any combination of cards here three-handed where I'm not behind. With King six in this bet, heads up might be completely different because somebody else could also be on a draw and try to push off of it. But if this other guy called, then somebody's got something, and he's right. I mean, we were in third place, on this hand going into it, and obviously we hit the right card and it held up. So if that's what he's asking, I'd feel a lot more comfortable with the ace. But I think I'm with you, and I think I told him at the same time. I would have folded this preflop. It's just not a hand I want to get involved with, really ever, and particularly not at this situation where I lost my train of thought already.
Well, I mean, like what I thought you were going to say, so maybe this is it, was that in this situation you could be drawing dead.
Oh.
Or you get lured into it because you might have hit your king, but you got no kicker. There's just so many reasons to not play this hand, regardless that this guy is crazy and wild and you know, playing too many hands. You still want to tighten up and play hands that he's going to get punished for, not you. And the other thing, too, I wanted to say real quick was that when they throw out stats like that to me, they're meaningless to me. Absolutely meaningless, because you don't know what the people have. You only know afterward, and you punched them into some calculator that you could have used at anyupmagazine.com to see where you were and justify your call later, because you might have been 40%, you know, stake in this pot or whatever. But really, to just say those stats and to try to justify it isn't fair, because you don't know what somebody else has. If they turned them face up, then you could pull out your little phone and go to anteupmagazine.com and use our calculator. Then you'd be like, all right, why not? But they're not going to do that for you. So saying the stats after the fact really means nothing to me, other than if you could have put them on those hands and then been correct, then maybe. Because I tell you what, if I knew somebody had queen nine and I knew somebody had aces, you know, I probably would have made the same decision that I made before, just because I didn't think that my hand was good anyway. But the only way it helps is if they have a suited ace there that beats you. Then you know you can get away from it. But other than that, you don't know what those cards really are, so saying the stats means nothing to me.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you. I mean, the stats have a place in the game, and I think it's good to use these kind of programs to kind of get better at identifying what your odds are. But you're right, without having the other cards in there, then it's much more difficult. So what I think is interesting is, and this is why I'm bad at math here, if somebody they had turned these cards up face over and I did not have the calculator to figure this out, I would have folded a lot quicker, I think. And it obviously would have been a mistake, because we were almost a coin flip. I mean, as close to a coin flip as you get to win this. And, you know, I'm willing to flip a coin to triple up, because that the odds are in your favor at that point, right?
Right.
I would not think that we're this close to winning this hand against those two hands.
Yeah, I mean, if they showed me face up that I was up against two pair and aces, I would have called, because that's the exact same thing as I'm behind any pair, and I still need to hit my flush to win anyway. So I would have called if I hadn't seen their cards, because I can't imagine I'm ahead of those two cards already, and that being the reason I would have called. The reason I'm calling is because I need to hit my draw, because I know I'm behind anyway. So seeing the cards does nothing for me. The only thing they would have done is if there's a suited ace of spades, then I would have folded.
All right, so here's an interesting thing to close the show, because I didn't put on the show notes, but I'm glad it's coming up here. On this trip, too, I get, you know, one of our new appetizers is the Island Breeze Casino, a day casino ship that sails out of West Palm Beach. And it's got the JB Gold poker room on it, and JB Gold, the 2006 world champion, plays five nights a week on it. Nice guy. I got a chance to play with him. So I got on the ship, right, and I was playing, and we were playing PLO. First time in my life, had the option of running it twice.
Oh, cool.
But I don't think I've ever done it at the home game. It doesn't usually come up in the home game. I think maybe once or twice somebody's
suggested. I don't know if anybody ever has.
Right.
And I don't play a lot of cash games, so it never comes up. So I never had the option, right? So I had a scenario where somebody asked me. It was probably one of the bigger pots ever. I was all in. The other guy was all in, so it was three-handed. JB was in it as well, too, I think. And I had the nuts at the time, nuts straight at the time, and really no redraw. And they said, hey, do you want to run it twice? And that scenario, absolutely. I got no backup here, right?
Yeah.
I'll take the shot. Ran it twice. I ended up rivering a boat on the top to win that half. I got obliterated on the bottom half. So had I not ran it twice, I would have won the whole thing, but I would have had got lucky. As crazy as that sounds, right?
Well, so when you say on top, you mean that was the first one that you ran?
The first board, yeah. The initial board. Had we not ran it twice,
you
I
would have won
the whole thing. But I had to hit a two-outer on the river to win.
Wow.
Because I was up against the same straight and a flush draw. The flush gets there on the turn, and then I river the boat.
Wow.
All right, so anyhow, the reason I bring that up is...
Obvious brag.
Of course, absolutely. Well, no, it's not an obvious brag. I made a mistake because I should have said no because I would have won all the money. Instead, it turned into this like half an hour split pot trying to figure out who pays who kind of thing. It was really complicated.
Yeah.
Because I was the short stack, not by much, but there was a small side pot, so they had to figure out. It was really complicated. It ended up being very simple, but it seemed really complicated. So in this scenario where I think this is where running it twice came from, probably, right?
Yeah.
But I shove with King 6 here. I know there's absolutely no chance that I'm winning this hand right now, right? So I'm willing to run it twice to give me a shot at least getting half of this pot, right?
Right.
Or am I wrong?
No, I mean, that sounds right because it gives you two chances to win rather than just the one and be done.
And I really don't think anybody at this table, from a mathematical standpoint, would want to run it twice. I mean, if you're one of those purists that just wants to, you know, because the guy with Queen 9... he's got to think, since there's three all-ins here, that he could be behind to a straight right now and has to boat up to get it. And obviously the ace is now with two all-ins. He's got to think that somebody's got something that's beating him right now. But he's got outs to probably long shot outs. I think everybody's got to run it twice here, right?
Yeah, I think the aces definitely want to run it twice because they're behind two pair and they want two chances to try to make a three of a kind or a two pair better. So, yeah, it seems like the queen nine might not want to. Maybe. Just because he's already ahead.
Likely, but at that point, I'm also wondering, you know, if I shoved here and I get two callers, I can't imagine two people are late. As it turns out, they were.
Yeah.
Because a straight is a possibility here. Again, it was a limp pot, so King 10, I think, is definitely people's range. Not so much the 10-8, but...
And they want two chances to suck out and make a boat.
Yeah, I'll take that shot.
That's pretty interesting. See, I like to... I've offered to do it once or twice in our game, and I think Gambit was one of them and said no, and I think Snuffy might have been one, and we did it, or he offered it to me, or I don't remember what it was. Maybe he said he wanted to do it, and then I don't think I wanted to at the time because I had the nuts at the time, or I don't know, but I think we've had a few times where people want to run it twice, and we've done it. I don't know. I'm not opposed to it. A lot of times I might be opposed to it just because I've, you know, why give you another chance to suck out on me when I've got the absolute nuts now?
Well, that's just it, right? You know, it's almost, I think it's like the pay the insurance on a blackjack and blackjack. I know you don't play blackjack, but, some of the things the casinos do when you get you're dealt a blackjack, but the dealer has an ace, you can essentially pay for insurance and they'll pay you even money so you don't lose, right?
Yeah.
You win a bet. But it's a bad bet because you're giving up half of your expected value.
Right.
By doing it, but a lot of players just want to play it safe and say, hey, I don't want to lose anything on this, so I'll take it. Long term, it's a terrible financial decision for you. So that's, I haven't really given the running the twice much thought until that night, and now I am, but I think that's really, I think it's the same scenario, is if you always run it twice, then I think you're giving up value. I could be wrong, but it seems to be the same scenario where it's safe at that point, you're probably guaranteed getting somebody. In my case, it was a huge pot, so I'm not upset about, I won a ton on it. I could have won a crap ton.
Yeah.
But it seemed safer. But yeah, I think long term, I think it's a negative EV for a lot of players.
Yeah. All right, Todd, I hope this helped you out. I'm not sure if it did, but I hope it did. And listen, Scott's going to be out there in California pretty soon. He's going on the cruise next week, Antioch Poker Cruise. So anybody listening who's going on the cruise with him, don't take too much of his money, all right? I want him to have some good stories when he comes back. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Locke.
We'll see you at the tables.
Annie Up is a production of AnnieUpMagazine.com and is recorded at WDAE 620 AM in Tampa. Contact us at podcast@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call our hotline at 813-448-1120. If you'd like to advertise, send us an email at advertising@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.